Order, if that's okay. Good afternoon. My name is John Palfrey, and on behalf of the Berkman Center, just thrilled to welcome you all here for the Digital Natives Forum series, our third time getting together in this format, much like the Berkman Tuesday lunch series, which I hope others you'll come back on Tuesdays as well. But the idea here is to have an interactive session talking about a key issue that we work on here in the Berkman Center and on which we want to collaborate with lots of people from other parts of the university and beyond. I'm just very grateful in particular to the five people who have joined us to lead discussions and to many of you who have joined us for other forum series. Thank you. Just by way of fair warning, we are being webcast. It is going out live. It will also be recorded for posterity. We think this is a good thing, but you're on notice that it's happening. So please do identify yourself and be on the record, but if you're not comfortable with that, please don't. So by way of format, we have, roughly speaking, 2 hours slated. If you have to go, we totally understand. People have busy lives, but we'll go roughly till 2:30. We'll start just by going around the room, quite full Berkman conference room here for those who are from afar watching this, and just say your name and affiliation and any other connection to the topic that you want to share. And then what we're going to do is have each of these five great guests and conversants lead us just briefly, each one, maybe five-ish minutes, which usually means seven, I think, in reality, about work that they've been doing that touches on the topic of young people and engagement in civic life. And then we'll pause on each topic for maybe 15 or 20 minutes of discussion and then go on to the next person. And that will be the way that we will allocate the 2 hours or so, and maybe at the end have some time for kind of more cross-cutting we'll start over here and come around.
Okay. I'm Daniel Thies. I'm at 2L at Harvard Law School, and I'm an old college buddy of Paul Selker.
Ah, welcome.
Great.
I'm Dina Sacco. I'm in the cyber law clinic at the
Berkman Center. Josh Sheldon. I work in the teacher education program lab at MIT, and I'm a colleague of one of the presenters.
And if you could, everyone just speak up a tiny bit because it's being recorded for people afar, that'd be great.
Ari Herzog, I'm a digital native. I write at ariwriter.com.
Julia
Forsman,
JD Mission.
I'm Dan Jones. I'm the digital media producer here.
Welcome to the Berkman Center, Dan. Nice to have you here.
I'm Amar Asher, a staff member.
I'm Jennifer Rothman. I'm a first year at the MIT education program, and I'm about to be a master's student.
I'm Christine Madsen. I'm a librarian and a doctoral student at the Young Creator
Institute. I'm Margaret Weigel. I work at the Good Clay and the Development Guides and Digital Media Projects on our Project Zero.
I'm Dave Peth, and I'm a producer at WGBH Interactive.
I'm Jason Kaufman. I'm a research fellow here. I study Facebook.
My name is Mark Siegel. I have a small production company that does technology-based learning for corporations and nonprofits.
I'm Jane Carillo. I'm the director of community at Locomota, and I teach digital studies at Emerson College. I'm Hillary Kolos, and I'm a incoming graduate student at MIT's Comparative Media Studies program, and I'll be working at Project Media
Literacy
Center. Okay. I'm Tony Lux. I work in the Law School Communications Department on social networking.
David, do you want to start and then we'll just come around this way?
Sure. I'm David Robinson, and I work at the Center for... Oh, sorry. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was suggesting that you go, and then we'll come around.
So I'm David Robinson. I'm at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University, and we too are constantly looking for synergies and collaborations.
I'm Kelly Whitney. I'm a doctoral student at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and I'm a researcher at Project New Media Literacies at MIT.
Russell Francis from Oxford University, Department of Education, and shortly to be working on Project New Media Literacies.
I'm Jay Youngdahl. I'm a lawyer and writer.
Catherine Bracey, Berkman Center staff.
Vandana Aneja, Berkman Center. I'm the project manager for Verdict.
Jillian York, Berkman Center staff.
Nasser Radadi, American Islamic Congress Outreach Director and Civil Rights Outreach Director with the Hands Across the Middle East Support Alliance, Civil Rights Initiative of the American Islamic Congress.
And one of our five conversants or discussants. Thank you for joining us, Nasser.
David Dockman. I teach a software design course at the Harvard School of Education, and I'm Chief Academic Officer at Tom Snyder Productions and Educational Software. Welcome back. Thank you for coming here.
I'm Miriam Smoon. I work on the Digital Natives Project here.
To whom we owe a great debt of gratitude for pulling this whole thing off. Very mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'm Charlie Nesson. I'm the founder of the Berkman Center and a professor here at the law school.
Wolf Richter, doctoral student, Oxford Internet Institute.
Tova Zeff, attorney visiting from California.
Graduate student at the Ed School and curriculum developer here for the Digital Arts Project.
My name's Emily Lin, and I'm a doctoral student in the Developmental Technologies Research Group at Tufts University.
Kelly Goff, and I'm a blogger and political commentator contributor to Huffington Post and BET.
And the author of Party Crashing,
right.
Which she's here to talk
you're
about
so
today.
Good. Yes. Right, you're so good. I'm the author
I know
of Party
you're
Crashing.
I know, like
I know,
to say
but
that.
Don't tell them I forgot that part.
It'll be recorded. I'll send them the link. We'll talk a lot about Party Crashing, the great new book by Kelly
yes.
Goff.
I'm Paul Selker. I'm the Director of Communications and Outreach for Obama Works. We're a grassroots organization. I'm one of your presenters, so you'll learn all about it in a moment. But I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for being here.
Do you want to jump?
Yes,
sure. I'm
Amino Adib.
I'm an intern with the
Berkman
Center.
Thank you for all the great stuff you've done and all that you will do.
Yeah.
I'm Judy Perry. I'm a research manager at the MIT Teacher Education Program, and you'll hear more from me in a bit.
I'm Sunshine Hilligus, Associate Professor of Government here and Director of the Program on Survey Research.
I'm Beth Coleman. I'm a Professor of Comparative Media Studies at MIT. Hi. Nice to meet you. Yeah. And I'm finishing a book on virtual worlds, and my next project is on real-time processes, so anybody doing real-time things.
Beth, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm John Palfrey from the Berkman Center, and again, just thrilled we're here and look forward to this with all of you. Along with Urs Gasser, I've been working on a research project called the Digital Natives Project, which Miriam and others have been leading us on, and one of the questions that we take up in that is whether or not young people are more or less engaged in civic life by virtue of these sort of mediations of digital technologies. I think we all came to the research project a few years ago hoping that that were so, that young people were getting more involved in civic life, however you define that, strengthening democracies, creating greater cross-cultural connections, more involved in literal party politics, as we'll hear from Kelly and Sunshine and others. I think the outcome of our study really was we didn't find as many young people using technologies in this way as we would have liked. There are seeds of change here, things that we can use to grow over time, but it's not like all young people who use digital technologies are rushing out to be involved in politics because of the internet. I think we've all kind of come to grips with the deflating of this particular bubble. But I don't think that it means that there's nothing to be done, nor that there is no reason for hope here, that in fact the politics of these online spaces, these network publics, really can be very meaningful, and that the engagement of young people can be something that over time is transformative of democracies here in the United States and abroad. We have the great pleasure of having five real experts in this space to help us think through both the connection between theory and practice here, and I think really the specific interventions that they think might work to help make these seeds of change turn into something greater. It's my great pleasure to start with Sunshine Hilligus, one of our colleagues here at Harvard, who's been doing just excellent work on how young people and others are involved in campaigns, very specifically, to lead off with the first 5 to 7 minutes, and we'll take questions after that, and then I think we'll go to Kelly and on from there. Yeah,
great. So I'm delighted to be here. I've been to a couple of Berkman Center events, but never actually in the space, and this is great, especially since you have my very favorite cookies in the world, the Lakota Bakery cookies. So I'll come back anytime now. So I'm a political scientist by training, and so one of the nice things about studying the internet and politics is that it touches so many different fields. And what I wanted to do is I hope this is what Miriam had in mind, is provide a little bit of a framework from a political science perspective. So when I was approached, she said there's really two questions that we'll be tackling today. One is how can digital media increase civic engagement among young people? And the second is how can we make it meaningful both you know, online and relative to offline. And so what I wanted to do is take both from my own research and political science research generally a little bit of how a social scientist would approach this question to maybe frame the discussion. And that is, when we're explaining political and civic participation or engagement, that often we flip it on its head and say, why is it that people are not engaged? And there are three factors that are the focus of most of the political science research, and the answer is basically that people aren't engaged because they can't, they don't want to be, and nobody asked them. So in other words, the three factors are the capacity, the motivation, and recruitment. And so those tend to be the three factors that we spend most of our time looking at, and I think are important in thinking about how the internet or other digital media play into this question of civic engagement. So if we start with the issue of recruitment and think about how the internet has changed the way that people are asked to participate in politics, asked to participate in civic life, I think here we find tremendous examples of what the potential is for digital media. Other research shows that the most effective request, the most effective recruitment comes from people that we know. And with the expansion of the ways that we can communicate with people, we've expanded the way that we can be touched by people we know and don't know to be asked to become politically active. And so whether it's text messaging or email or online, I mean, we'll hear, I think, examples today that has created more opportunities for people to reach out and bring someone into the process. And in terms of social obligation, I mean, think about how many people have, you know, contributed to, you know, your neighbor's fundraiser or a friend's daughter's Girl Scout cookies or, you know, right? You do things because people ask you. And I think we can't minimize the importance of being asked to participate as one of the most important factors in determining whether somebody will. I think in particular when we start looking at digital social networks, because of the importance of the personal connection, that this is where we see one real potential for increasing civic and political engagement among young people, and whether you're talking about through Facebook or LinkedIn or, you know, go on and on, that the social networks are important because research has shown that it's the people that you know are most effective in getting you to do something. At the same time, I have to point out that the expansion of modes of communication have also made it somewhat more difficult for some of us to reach out and engage young people. A third of 18 to 29-year-olds have only a cell phone. They don't have a landline. And so if there are organizations or groups or candidates or political causes that are trying to engage people through traditional means like telephones, it's more difficult to do so because there is not a single list of cell phones. And so as someone who conducts surveys, I could talk for hours about how this has complicated our life. But I think just generally speaking for those interested in engagement, that you know, probably the positive outweigh the negative, but it's not entirely all positive. So the second issue is capacity. So here we're often referring to you know, ability, whether it's time, money, or skills. And here again, I think that we find some tremendous examples and evidence that digital media and the internet in particular can help to overcome the barriers of time, money, and information. I mean, you think about information and what is possible now, right? If at one time you had to first know that you had to go to a county clerk's office and then, you know, traipse on down there during office hours to get registered to vote, the fact that we can now download and send it in is a tremendous reduction in a barrier to participation. So rather than having to, you know, type up a letter to your congressman and, you know, lick a stamp and put it in the mail, we can send an email. There is more information available more quickly, in more places than ever, I think, we dreamed, you know, 20 years ago or so. So I think we can't downplay the importance of having information available to us, because what it does is it reduces one of the barriers to participation. Same with time and money. It's less, you know, it takes less time to do a lot of the same things that we had done before with the internet, and it costs less, right? You know, being able to figure out what you need to do to make a political contribution at one time, meant that only those who are writing a pretty substantial check were participating, and now it's become clear that you can contribute $25 and you can do it quickly and without much burden. The other thing is that it's now very easy to find other people, organizations that are like you, and so it doesn't require that you be involved in an organization that's in your neighborhood or in your town, whether you're talking about the next town over or around the country. Again, it reduces the burden, that information burden, so that you're able to find where it is you want to be engaged with little effort. And of course, these are the same networks, right? Once you're involved in an organization, whether it starts out political or not, that then becomes a network for recruitment, which is, right, one of the first factors that I mentioned. This concern about whether or not this engagement is meaningful, though, is relevant, because in reducing the burden, right, in reducing the obstacles necessary to become involved in an organization or in politics, it makes it easier and, to some extent, maybe less meaningful. So in the United States, 80% of Americans are members of some group, whether political or not. On average, people belong to 4 to 5 organizations. And yet, if you look at the number of people in the last year who have attended a group meeting, it's less than a third. And so, you know, we're very happy to write a check and belong to the Sierra Club, but do we do something more than that? Not always. And so I think it is an important question about whether that engagement is meaningful. But at the same time, offline engagement, you know, you can write that check offline and it can mean the exact same thing. But finally, I wanted to mention the issue of motivation. And I think this is the point that I think is perhaps most relevant to the question of how can we increase civic engagement among youth. And that this is where the promise of the internet has fallen short. Because all the information is out there, the reduction in time, the reduction in money is all great if you are motivated to participate. But the internet, the information in and of itself, doesn't make someone interested in politics. It doesn't make someone want to be engaged. And so the findings of social science research is, in fact, that the internet and other forms of media choice and the expansion of information have actually exacerbated inequalities in political knowledge. And the reason is because for those who are motivated, those who are interested, there is more information out there than ever before. You can become more informed than anyone dreamed possible. But for those who are not motivated and not interested, it allows you to avoid politics like never before. And the example I always give is think about if you wanted to watch television while you were eating dinner in the 1960s. You had no choice but to sit in front of the TV and learn about politics from the nightly news. Today, if you want to absorb information while you eat, you not only can you sit in front of any number of non-political TV programs, but you can browse online and, again, never once encounter this byproduct of becoming politically informed. And political information is, of course, one of the important resources that we need for someone to be engaged. And so I think I'll end by just saying this is where I think that the puzzle that I hope that we can focus a lot of the discussion is reducing the barriers are great. And this is where, you know, the internet really has had tremendous impact is in bringing those people who are motivated and interested up to a new level of civic engagement like we haven't seen before. But the dilemma is, how do we get someone to be motivated? How do we get someone interested that isn't? The bit of research that's out there suggests partly it's a bit of force feeding. It's force feeding why the engagement, whether political or civic, is relevant to the person's life. And so if we start looking there, it almost becomes less about new websites and more about how we can get information to people who otherwise wouldn't go looking for it.
Okay, so I think I'll pass it over there, but I'm happy to talk more about any of those factors.
Sunshine, thank you. A great, helpful frame. Welcome, Dorothy Isenberg from the Kennedy School. She's taught on this for decades.
Found in your research that it's being asked by people you know that matters. And I wondered, have you also looked at the phenomenon of how young people meet others online? Because if you look back at, well, the civil rights movement that I was involved in, the way we mobilized minority voters who hadn't voted before because they didn't think they could, because they wouldn't be turned away at the polls, it was basically a lot of young people from church groups went door to door to our neighbors, and we knocked on the door, we talked to people, and we said, yes, you can vote now, yes, it matters, and it was the face-to-face, people you know persuasion, and I think there is research that shows that young people are meeting others in their social networks online, and maybe that's the path to explore for the how you get people motivated.
I mean, absolutely, that there is that potential, and in particular, is there's a potential to turn what is a social network that is not political into something that again, it is one way that you can get information to people who wouldn't go looking for it. And, you think about, with Facebook, how exactly you do that before somebody unfriends you, right? But
there's the second part of the problem, which is the colonization of these social networks by marketing forces.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so my students have a great deal of cynicism about people who befriend you on Facebook are just being hired by somebody to sell new sneakers or something. Sorry,
which is exactly hits the point that it's all about people you really know.
Right.
Right.
Or people you can meet and talk to.
And trust. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On the other side of how meaningful engagement is, one of the things I ran into with the previous organization was how meaningful elected officials find emails. One of the things you mentioned was drafting off an email, and then whether that's weighed in the same way a piece of paper is, and that feedback as it comes back to someone who's getting involved for the first time, whether that is a disincentive or not to further engagement if someone just discards their email because it was an email rather than a letter.
Well, and I think there is no doubt that when you get in the email from an organization a form letter that they ask you to then email along, that is absolutely discounted, right? And every elected official will do that. Before the email, organizations were doing the same thing with hard copies as well. And I think the point is just that there's a lot of variability both online and offline about meaningful activity. Because offline, you'll find, right? I mean, one of the things that we find that people are least likely to do is actually go to a rally or a protest. But politicians are also well aware that if you have a good band at a protest, that a lot of people are going for the band, not because they necessarily care about the cause.
Goff has written a book on the hip-hop generation. So
right. So I think that the key point is just that there is variation in how meaningful an activity is, both online and offline. And to some extent, it is a matter of how deeply sincere something appears. And an email can be very powerful, but it also can be cut and pasted.
A bit better about the different levels of engagement. So you kind of said, well, 80% belong to an organization, I guess, that includes all the basketball and sports organizations in the States. But so have you seen any indication that people who are active online, whatever that means, are more deeply involved, or like what are the different levels of like formal belonging to something, showing up to certain activities, writing an email yourself, or like taking political action? Have you seen your research?
So there's no doubt that any indicator you'll look at finds that those who are online are more engaged, more active, on average. I think that unfortunately you can't necessarily say that it's a causal story, both because of, you know, the so-called digital divide, but also, just because of the way that, again, the internet has reduced some of the barriers to engagement so that they are not quite equivalent to the same obstacles that somebody who's not online has to go through to do them. So And this is the dilemma for empirical social scientists, is exactly how you untangle, you know, exactly a causal effect.
Well, you have to control for education, surely, because internet users tend to be more educated, and more educated people tend to participate more.
Right.
I'm curious a little bit about what constitutes civic information these days, given that John Stewart's the number four most trusted newscaster in America, right, or something. So that what the quality of civic information of news just seems so different today than it was.
Well, so this is also one of the issues, right, is that on the one hand, someone who wants to compare the candidates today need only go into Google, put in McCain, Obama issues, and they'll pull up a dozen different websites that list on every issue voting records and statements going back, you know, decades. Imagine, you know, 30 years ago, you were at the mercy of the traditional media, or you had to do a heck of a lot of digging, right, to find out this information. And so there's always the issue of trusted sources of information, and certainly I think one of the big issues we've seen in this campaign and previous campaigns is how you know, information that is not trustworthy nonetheless kind of circulates around the web and has an impact. But at the same time, for those who are interested, you know, you can find the information that you need, whereas in the past you really relied on the media to provide you with the information.
Maybe one more question for Sunshine, then we'll move on. Yeah.
It's a question/comment. Sometimes these different realms, all this information is more confusing than clarifying for people, and it actually ends up paralyzing them. So they think it all kind of ends up a wash, and so they don't take sides. And part of what we've been hearing in our research is that engagement is sometimes fostered by the schools, and it's not clear how involved they actually are if they're padding their resumes. And also, engagement can be giving $5 to Obama, and that's the end of it. So I think that, you know, the question of gradation is really important to consider.
Great, great point.
Absolutely, and let me just say, I mean, this is going to be one of, for those of you who are Obama supporters, right, this is going to be one of the big dilemmas, and that is that his base of support so much depends on young people who, if you look at turnout rates, are much, much less likely to turn out. And you know, again, I could speak for hours about why exactly that is the case. But you know, is the people who have Facebook friended Obama, are they actually going to go to the polls? It is something that the campaign has to struggle with, because it is so much easier to you know, click and show your support on Facebook than to actually register to vote within 30 days in most states and actually get to the polls. I think the just one final thing, and that is the role of education. I think when I said we have to force feed information to those who are not interested, the kind of most obvious place that can happen is within schools. And there is, I think, a considerable research, some of that I've worked on, that is one way that you can get people politically engaged is through the schools, right? Because that's one way that you equalize information.
Bit now to somebody who is the definition of motivated, who I actually met first on a campaign. She was a college student and turning, I suspect, unpaid even in this space, who has made much of both her interest in this area and the affordances of the web and these media, and has come out with a book recently called Party Crashing. If you haven't read it, I think you should, and it's on the hip-hop generation. Kelly, you have 5 to 7.
Okay, do I need this, or...?
It'd be better if you took it, just for posterity's sake.
Okay.
Although their microphones are on the cable work, too.
Okay. So everyone can hear me okay?
Yeah.
I usually don't get complaints for not being loud enough, so. So I'd like to start this very serious conversation by asking a pretty shallow question, and I hope you will all cooperate by being honest. Who here has heard of Perez Hilton? Perez. Distinction. That's okay. There's a story there connecting the two, but I won't go into it here. Who here has heard, that was a pretty impressive showing, I would say, right?
So, okay, well, on that note then, John, who here has heard of YBF.com? Who here has heard of YBF.com? Very impressive. You just surprised me, actually. We'll talk later. So the reason I wanted to start the conversation by asking that is because YBF, according to Yahoo, is one of the top 10 gossip sites online. It's a black gossip site. And what's interesting in my conversations is it's something I didn't spend a lot of time dwelling on, except for now a lot of my friends are bloggers for very, you know, prominent sites and are in the media. And what we started noticing, one of them actually just really pointed it out actually as we were at the convention. I slipped something in a conversation and she said, oh, where'd you hear that from? And I said, oh, online somewhere. And she's like, Kelly, we read the same blogs. How is that possible that I didn't hear about that? And I said, yeah, that's weird. Where did I hear it? And I started thinking to myself, oh, I think I read it on YBF or on BossUp or any of the other number of blogs that are a part of my day-to-day existence that I just kind of forgot or never thought about the fact they're not necessarily a part of my some of my non-black friends' existence, day-to-day existence. And I wanted to start by discussing that because the internet, there's still a bit of a disconnect, somewhat of an ethnic, cultural, racial disconnect that I think a lot of us, it doesn't get talked about that much because I think a lot of us forget about it because the internet is such a great place for bringing people together and it's really good about that. But I think it's sort of a little bit like church where it's sort of one of the last bastions of segregation that no one really notices, right? Because you're so busy trying to do good stuff with it that you don't really think about it. And I bring that up because, you know, there have been a lot of different studies in the last couple of years. I'm sure ones which the Berkman Center has done a ton of research and discussions about, like the Pew study on differences of behavior among different racial groups. And I don't want to spend too much time on that because I want to move on to something else. But I wanted to open the conversation by mentioning that and just a couple of the quick statistics that some of the more recent studies have had. 76% of Black Americans reported that so-called ethnic sites are a part of their internet experience, which is something I had never thought about until I saw the number, but I definitely fit into that category. It's just something that, again, I didn't dwell on, but I was like, oh, I guess that kind of would be me. 52% of African Americans said people of color have unique needs on the internet compared to only 16% of Latinos, which I thought was interesting. And only 37% of African Americans felt there was adequate content on the web for them. Now, I have a bunch of different studies, and I'm happy to send them to John so he can post them if anyone's interested in seeing them. But I raise all that just because I wanted to sort of set the tone for this, that I think that when we're sort of talking about some of the unfulfilled promise of the internet, I actually kind of want to throw a wrench in the conversation and say that I kind of disagree. I think a lot of the promise has been fulfilled. And what I mean by that is I would say that the Jenna 6 case completely turned on its ear everything I ever thought about particularly younger African Americans and internet and social activism. Now, I think John can probably attest to this, that there's nothing scarier for an author who's working on a present-day topic than the idea that something could fall from the sky and completely either turn your book completely irrelevant or completely change the last 200 pages. So as someone who was writing about the election, you know, I literally was having this like, God, I hope this isn't really selfish, but if you could please just make sure that, because with all due respect to the Edwards family, the timing could have been a lot more disastrous, I think, for a lot of us who were sort of in the process of doing writing. But, you know, that being said, I bring that up because I was in the process of working on a book, Party Crashing, which was a lot about the changing perspective on civil rights activism, and the intersections of civil rights and politics. And then the Jenna 6 case really started gaining ground, and you had the first full throttle, some of the biggest protests that we've seen since the 1960s. Oh, okay, because I was worried I only had 5 minutes. Do people know the Jenna 6 case, the basics of it? Okay, so really, really quickly what I'll say, it's very complicated and convoluted, so I would encourage you to Google it. But the nuts and bolts of it is there was an incident on a high school campus where in Jenna, Louisiana, where nooses were hung from a tree. There was an altercation between some students. The students initially involved in the altercation, particularly the white students, received, you know, a boys will be boys type of punishment on campus. There was an altercation off campus and where a white student was knocked unconscious and a black student was tried for attempted murder. And so the reason that I raise it as something that completely altered my perspective on young people, internet activism, and particularly in communities of color, is because the Jenna 6 case essentially put the Black blogosphere on the map, but the Black blogosphere also, in a lot of ways, put the Jenna 6 case on the map. It was something that started happening. I mean, the details of this case started in 2006. The protest rallies that all of us saw on TV did not happen until September of 2007. And, you know, what was interesting is some of the, you know, these are people that just by pure statistics are not necessarily people who are at the head of and forefront of civic engagement. They're not the people that when political consultants are putting together ads, they're thinking, you know who's going to get really involved? You know who would probably start a protest for me? A young African American. Let's target them. That's not what they're thinking when they're putting together political advertisements. And yet these turn out to be the people who brought about this level of change. I mean, who got people like the idea that John Mellencamp wrote a song for the Jenna 6, right, is pretty incredible. But it was a year in the making, and it was something that was percolating really, like I said, in this Black blogosphere that a lot of people didn't even know existed. And, you know, I was one of the people who was getting emails from friends saying, have you heard about this case? Have you heard about this case? Have you heard about this case? Check it out. See how you can help. Here's how you can help. And then some really prominent Black bloggers did something really unique, which is that they conducted what they called a blog-in, where a group of them agreed that on the same day we're all going to write about this case. And that essentially just put it into the stratosphere. And so I know I only have a couple minutes, but I just wanted to read a couple of quotes that I thought are really profound about that case and Netroots activism. One of the most fascinating things about this, and I talk about this in the book, is that I felt that the Jenna 6, the activism around that case, really represented sort of a passing of the torch in a very tangible sense. There's been all this talk and writing by people like me about there being a transition among the Black leadership, but that case was fascinating in that people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson showed up at the rally. They didn't put the rallies together. They were not the people who spearheaded the activism around this case. It was the young people who spearheaded it. And Al Sharpton, to his credit, said, I read about it online. I heard about this case online. And that's how I got involved. And so I just wanted to read a couple of quick quotes, which I really think frame the significance of the case and what it means perhaps for the future and me being more optimistic about the use of the internet and the role of it in civic engagement. 10 years ago, this could not have happened. You didn't have the internet, you didn't have Black bloggers, and you didn't have national radio shows. Now we can talk to all of Black America every day. That was Al Sharpton to the Chicago Tribune. These events happened in 2006. For months, they utterly failed to penetrate the national consciousness. We still might not know about what happened in Jenna if the case hadn't been noticed by bloggers who sounded the alarm. That was Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. And lastly, web blogging and coverage gets picked up by hundreds, then thousands, and ultimately by national Black radio shows, which cumulatively reach millions every day. You reach the constituents you want to reach because friends and colleagues send it to other socially conscious Black folks. That was Chris Rabb, who's a Netroots activist in Black Enterprise magazine, and he's significant because he was one of the credentialed African American bloggers back in the 2004 political conventions. And the last thing I would say is that the activism around the Jenna 6 case was actually named by Wiretap, the online magazine, as one of the 10 most significant moments of youth activism in the country for 2007. So I think that's pretty much. I'm happy to leave it there. I think that, sure, I mean, I guess the thing that I'm most focused on at this point is I don't underestimate the power and involvement of young people. I've done so many interviews this year where, I mean, before the Iowa caucus, after the Iowa caucus, where I'm talking to people who just are, you know, are just skeptical, and we know who tends to predominate the news media, right? So that's why they're going to be skeptical. But I also know they're skeptical about people like me, and not because of age, but because, you know, people of color don't tend to turn out. And so I guess what I would throw out there, I don't know if it's so much of a question as just sort of a food for thought, is I think that what the Jenna 6 activism proves, and I think what the Obama campaign has proved, is that if you find the hook for engaging people, they'll become engaged, right? And I know that sounds like really simplistic, but if you meet people where they are, and I think a lot of what this conversation is about is that the people who became activists in Gen 6 are not people who traditionally vote. They're not people that people think of as activists. They've been written off. I mean, I was doing interviews with the Democratic National Convention who said, the Democratic National Committee last year, they were saying to me, we're really concerned about young black men because they don't get involved. We're concerned about losing them. We think our, you know, we think our base is in real trouble 10 years from now because these young black men aren't doing anything. They were the ones who were on the ground. So I think that the lesson to be learned is, before we get too pessimistic about the opportunities that are there and the promise being fulfilled of the internet, I think that if people make the effort to meet people where they are, then people are game to maximize the potential and power for internet activism.
I'm wondering how this evolving community interacts with the question of the digital divide, given that African Americans tend to be disproportionately poor and disproportionately under-resourced schools. How is this inequality within the African American community play out in terms of who can access these online communities?
I'm so glad you asked that. That's a really interesting question, and one I'm fascinated by myself. I have a chapter in the book that's all just about class and how it's starting to rear its head in some of the politics going on today. But in terms of the internet, here's what I would say is, you know, there are studies that were showing, there was the one 5 years ago, and I can't remember who it was by, that showed, to everyone's surprise, that it was like African Americans were disproportionately using the internet more. Do you remember that one? I mean, I can pull it up, but I remember I was surprised. Like, I use it every day, but I was like, really? You know? And so back to your question, I think that part of what that goes into is I have this theory, which I haven't researched and I can't prove. I'm just going strictly anecdotal. But you take someone like my friends and me who are allegedly middle class or whatever you want to label us, and I feel like we probably use the internet more, like almost double perhaps than some of our white friends, or what we use it for is more, because a lot of what we use it for, and I've had this conversations with other middle class or upper class African American friends, are for necessities that we have a hard time accessing because of the class circles we move within. And here's just two really quick anecdotal examples I would give. I have a friend who just started business school at Dartmouth. Okay. Sure, you can probably guess in terms of what the makeup is of the business class at Dartmouth. So he already said from going to his first, whatever the first get-together is for the students, he's like, yeah, there aren't that many black women. Shocking. So if he's looking to date, he wants to date someone who's African-American, he's probably going to be spending more time online than just the traditional match.com channels, right? He has certain limitations. I think about things like when I started doing television interviews. I mean, John knows me. I'm more of a ponytail and, you know, slap on some gloss kind of gal, but unfortunately that doesn't fly in the world of light. So I found myself spending more time on the internet because I'd go into a studio and they'd use something on my hair to make it look TV friendly, which we all know what that's code for. So what do? I run home and I go online, I look up the name of the product that they used, and I ended up ordering them because you can only find them online. Do you know what I mean? There's certain like things that when, you know, you kind of combine the race and the class element and getting used to sort of being, I don't want to call an exception, but you, when you're in certain environments where you're not, there aren't a lot of people like you, I can't always go to my white friends and say, what's that? Where'd you get your makeup? You know what I mean? Like, I can't always do that.
African Americans that aren't online are only further marginalized because now we're creating distance in your community.
Sure, although it works both ways, right? Because, you know, one of the things that some of the studies were showing is that you found that when there's a class difference, more black Americans were using it just for a job, like just for researching how to get a job, right? But then they didn't have it at home. So they were having to, it was limiting what they were using it for, some fun personal stuff. But they were going, I guess, to a library and looking up, you know, going on some of the job websites to find jobs. You're right. I think it's twofold, though, because you go into the chat rooms because you're trying to find someone to date because there aren't women that you want to date at Dartmouth, so you end up meeting more women online, right, from other places. It's kind of this circular thing. I think that there hasn't been enough research done for obvious reasons, again, part of this divide, of people really knowing how to get at it.
I just wanted to add a footnote to that. It may have been Carnegie Mellon, and I'm not sure, that did study you're referring to, but I do remember the sad fact of it was that a lot of African Americans were using the net because of the hassles encountered in shopping face to face. And that there were many reports of discrimination, buying clothes, anything you want to name, where they were really treated very badly, and the anonymity of the net and ordering over the net made life more simple.
It's really interesting she raised that, because one of my friends runs a fabulous blog called Stereohyped, which won a Webby last year, and it's pretty new. And she edits it, and she actually posted a couple weeks ago. It wasn't even like linked to a news story. She just said, okay, I just have something to ask. That was how she opened the story. And she said she was shopping with her boyfriend, who's a lawyer. And they were, you know, but they weren't dressed in suits because they were, it was Saturday. You dress in what you, Saturday. And they talked about being followed around this store. And of course, the person clearly didn't know they were, he's a lawyer and she's a, you know, an editor or what have you. And so she literally just posted on our site, can any of you just send in your stories? Do any of you have stories? And I mean, just being frank, it's one of the last bastions. If you're black, you probably have a story. And so I remember I was laughing so hard at it when I was reading, because people had such sarcastic, like, you know, oh, yeah, it was really funny. Yeah, I'm going to steal your $2 or whatever. And I was telling, again, one of my white blogger friends this, and she, her reaction was, well, but nothing like that has ever happened to you, right? And, you know, and again, I kind of thought, I would start laughing. I was like, are you being serious? And she said, no, I mean, that would never happen. But again, just sort of a difference. You know, we're sort of in different online worlds, although partially the same, because I'm reading the blogs that she reads, you know.
Can you just pivot us back toward the engagement issue from where you brought us, which I think is a really helpful point? Is there, of the kinds of interventions that you've seen that might lead, in fact, to young African Americans or young people in other groups that may have commercialized in different ways that have worked?
Sure.
In a really in a tactical sense, what are the things that might be leading to what I think the positive dynamic?
Sure, I absolutely, and I'm happy to pivot it over to my friend here from the Obama campaign. I think that one of the things that, and I don't want to speak for them, everyone talks about how nervous the Obama campaign must, you know, be because of relying on, like, younger voters. I actually think that they should be or would be really enthused, because they've managed to tap into a group of voters that no other candidate so far has. And what I mean by that is skepticism about John Kerry was percolating on some of the black blogs eons before the election. And clearly no one on his team was reading it, because if they'd even just taken, you know, 20 seconds to skim a few of them, I think they would have known that he might have a problem in Ohio, you know? And so that being said, I think what's interesting about the Obama campaign and about the potential there is, like I said, I was hearing all of this panic from the Democratic National Committee and from the higher ups about, we have no idea what to do with young black men. They're just not involved. They're completely disengaged from the process. They don't trust the system. They don't trust politics. They don't want to be involved. And then the activism in the Jenna 6 case proved that that's not true. And I would say also some of the early primaries have shown that that's not true. People were using Facebook. They used text messaging. They may not be using it through the traditional channels, which I think goes back to this conversation about people, who was it saying before, about gradations, right? They may not be going to the Democratic National Committee or America Votes and saying, this is my email address, I want you to contact me and I will show up and volunteer this way. What they are doing is saying among their circle of friends, man, Obama's having this event, he needs people to show up. They're saying if it doesn't go well, then it could really hurt him next month. Show up. Just show up. People are showing up. And I think that when you go back and you look at some of the states like North Carolina, Indiana, I think part of the untold story and what doesn't get covered as much in the media is that you had pockets of voters like that who really made the difference in the long run. They made the difference. And I'm not saying that they're going to make a difference for another candidate or it's something that's sustainable. I get asked this all the time. But I think that, and back to her point about, they may not be showing up in some of the polling because a lot of the polling is still done by landlines, which is increasingly antiquated. But I think that they're there. And I think that they're there. So that's what I would say.
Something peer-to-peer, and then those guys showed up, right? And
right.
In some ways, I think
Paul, not to take away your punchline, but there is something there that relates these two stories, sure. right, in terms of what you've been doing with Obama Works and outside the traditional campaign structure and in a really interesting non-hierarchical way that I think has, you know, real resonance with the story that Kelly wrote. So over to you.
I guess I'll redirect this microphone a little bit. So I'm Paul Selker. I'm the communications and outreach director at Obama Works, which I'll tell you about in a second. I'm delighted to be here in particular because I just actually graduated from Yale College, this past spring, and it's comforting to know that one can never fully leave the academy. I can only hope. So I guess I'll just reiterate the question of the day because it'll help me and hopefully everyone else, which is, you know, how can digital media tools enable youths to motivate one another to create meaningful change? And I will warn you in advance that my answer ultimately is going to be agency. Meaningful, not trivial agency, the ability to make choices that result in outcomes that are not trivial, that are outcomes that, you know, that are meaningful outcomes. So I'm going to dive in for a second and talk for a moment about Obama Works and what we are. So we are now a national grassroots organization. We are dedicated to, I should say we're independent of the campaign, if that wasn't clear already. I would never want to put myself out as some sort of spokesman that I'm not. We are dedicated to empowering Obama supporters, particularly ones who are first-time supporters or not necessarily inclined or wanting to do traditional campaign activities like door-to-door or phone banking. We're out to empower them to do meaningful service, community service in their neighborhoods. We link it with Obama visibility and voter registration. We think it's very resonant, synergistic, whatever you want to call it, with Obama's message of communities meeting government halfway to create real change. We also think that service and politics are two sides of the same coin, which is a desire to help one's community, whether that community is one's neighborhood or one's country. That's all well and good, and we've had a lot of success, and it's been a lot of fun, but as of February, when we were getting started, we had none of the success and a lot of obstacles before us, and we used digital tools, among other things, to overcome them, so that's what I'm going to talk about. You know, our obstacles were no one knows who we are. We are three guys. We have no money, and we don't even have a website yet. And we're asking people to do a lot. We're asking people, and ultimately, you know, this is what people do when they get involved with Obama Works. We are asking them to in their communities where we aren't, go out and do logistical planning. You know, we're asking them to do publicity. We're asking them to organize events. We're asking them to generate the events. In fact, almost all of our events were. All the events that we do were originated by members. We only came up with a couple that we suggest to people. So we're asking a whole lot of people. So how can we sort of induce them to take this huge action? And so I'm going to pause for a second, take it away from Obama Works, and introduce a paradigm that I like to use to think about digital tools, but also just tools in general. And it's the paradigm of the lever and the object. And you'll forgive me, it's a simple paradigm, but I'm a practitioner, not an academic, as I guess you would call me. So in the real world, if I have something I want to move, an object I want to move, and I'm one guy, which I am, I would choose some sort of device to move it, maybe, say, a lever. And the larger the object, the larger the lever. So I think about it the same way in the digital world, except a little more abstracted. So objects are outcomes. Levers are the forces I'm using to move them. And I can sort of think about the outcome and think about what sort of lever I might need, but also think about the lever and think about what sort of outcome I might be able to generate. And so I'm going to try and make that real with an example that's not Obama Works for a second. And the one I'm going to use is I'm going to talk about for a second the social applications that are out there on social networks to mobilize social actions like giving gifts online or showing off for public good. Has anyone ever here been on Facebook and seen the Green Book or Lil Green Patch?
Yes.
These are really cool. I think these are just brilliant. They're basically, you know, items that one can put on one's Facebook profile and show off that they are doing something good for the environment by either buying carbon offsets or buying acres of rainforest. And the way it actually works is that. And incidentally, there are social features, too, so you spread this thing to your friends. And the way it actually works is there are sponsors, companies that are monetizing this process, giving the money that is subsequently donated to the rainforest or the carbon offsets, and they get in return you associating their name with this good thing. And this is remarkable, I think, because the object that's being moved in this case, you know, sort of the object that a lever is moving is really trivial. I mean, someone's clicking a button and putting something on their profile, but the lever that's moving it is the biggest lever, I think, on social networks, certainly maybe in the whole world, which is the ability to show off. You know, someone puts something on their profile, they show off not only how many friends they have, but that they are altruistic and excellent. And you know, if anyone doubted how big of a lever showing off was, I'd say it's bigger than fun, even if you think about a tattoo, not very much fun, great at showing off. I actually think tattoos are really great metaphor for widgets on a social network. Anyway, so a sort of negative example on the other side of the object lever paradigm is our sites that aim to inform, you know, about causes or issues, and they're hugely important. And people can use search engines to find the information they want, and we need sites like this. They're very important, but at the end of the day, they're using a small lever and a large object. The large object is they want people to go to the site, seek out information, and then not only do that, but then take it another step, one step removed, and act on it. So that's initiative, that's a lot of things. And the lever that's being used there is ultimately people's interest, their private interest, and their private altruism. And it's harder to show that off, unfortunately. So you're going to get people to do it, but they'll be preaching to the choir, by and large. And I think, as we have seen from the, you know, 1.6 million people give gifts, or 1.6 million gifts are given on the Facebook every day, I discovered recently, and not nearly that many people go to your average informative site, as important as they are. So moving back to ObamaWorks for a second, and I promise I won't be much longer because I know I'm pushing my time. We're asking to move a huge object. The object we want to move is people, as I said, going out into their communities and organizing and recruiting their friends and doing, you know, and talking to newspapers and all sorts of things. So there's a big object. And so we, you know, didn't think of it in these terms, but ultimately we had to decide what our lever was going to be. And it has been, at every step of the way, agency, which is sort of an omnibus lever at the end of the day. It's, you know, it is prestige. You know, people get to, you know, talk to, recruit their friends and show how important they are. They get to, you know, show the community how important they are. They get to show their own future employers how important they are when they put it on their resume. And we get college students, you know, much like myself, sending their resumes to us all the time saying, I want to start an ObamaWorks chapter. And that I don't think would ever happen if we weren't doling out agency. So, anyway, at the end of the day, agency is only so digital. You know, the events we're doing are in real life, not in the digital world, but there are a lot of tools we use to sort of lighten the load, and also give new kinds of agency online. And I can sort of talk about these more later, but I'll just say we let people build their own websites on our website. So, you know, ObamaWorks Harrisburg, for instance. If you go to our website, you can go to harrisburg.obamaworks.org, and lo and behold, there is a site that is not built by me. It's not built by anyone at our sort of central command for whatever that is, and it's instead built in a very unrestricted way. It's essentially a wiki that looks a little more opaque than a standard wiki to outside users who aren't logged in. It was a wiki that was built by the Harrisburg site. Everything on there is theirs. They get to show off what they're doing. We, as a side effect, get to monitor what they're doing, which would otherwise be very difficult. And they get a really unusual form of prestige in a world of social networks where your interactions with people are sort of channeled into narrow categories of interaction. You know, you can poke someone, you can do whatever. Nowhere, no social network lets you design your web page and put it up in a place of honor. And you know, we've done all sorts of things to prevent this not being abused. Another thing we've done is we let people post events on our front page, just really trivially. And there are a whole lot of ways we do that in protect it from abuse and whatever, and I can talk about that. But ultimately, we scrape my.barackobama.com, which is a fantastic tool for the data about that event. So they create their event, they say, come back to us, they give us the event, we scrape the event automatically, and we post it. In any case, so there are these digital tools that we've been using to create agency, and I'm out of time, so I'll close with the thought that it's very easy to automate and sort of crowdsource, I guess would be the relevant buzzword, actions like writing a letter, turning it into just a button press, and you can get lots of people to do that by using big levers like prestige, the ability to show off, and I don't mean to knock that because it's important, but I think the real prize will ultimately go to people who can crowdsource agency. You know, Jimmy Wales at Wikipedia has crowdsourced agency. The Obama campaign has started to crowdsource agency, you know, giving the people the opportunity to make meaningful decisions. And, you know, we have tried to do it with some success. And I think it's the folks who are going to crowdsource agency who are ultimately going to tap into people's creativity. They're going to tap into their passion, their hopes, you know, their dreams, everything, and ultimately their best efforts. And so with that, I'll close.
Thank you. Jason, this makes me think of some of your research. I'd love to hear your reaction.
reactions to what sounded like a shot across the bow to some of the social network sites and politics, but maybe I'll let you think about that. Maybe a question closer.
Okay, I have a comment, I guess, to the thread that links all three of your presentations, starting with the sort of what motivates people and coming to the question of agency. And I think, I guess this has not been my idea since a freshman this summer in class told me, I always ask my freshman class, how many of you are registered to vote, and I get served. Order 10%. Every single person was registered to vote, and I just looked stunned. And they said, "What's wrong?" I said, "You're all registered to vote. Why?" And they said, "Because we think it makes a difference this time." And it's that we think it makes a difference is essential to the agency. And I don't know if that's the thing. Maybe we communicate, because I don't think we can create the conditions under which your vote makes a difference. But certainly, that seems to be what's happening to this generation of young people.
Yeah, I mean. I was thinking about that. You know, no one wonders when they're in a stadium, you know, if they maybe shouldn't clap because their specific clap, you know, like won't create an effect. And I've often wondered, you know, why do people not perceive voting in that way? But it might be because partially because they're not in the stadium, or the stadium's a lot bigger. You know, it's your state or your country. But I think the ability to take, you know, larger, more consequential actions might induce people to believe that maybe, you know, their clap, their vote actually has relevance.
I was going to say, too, I think that I'm not sure where the age split is, but I think that as the years progress, and particularly depending on how this election turns out, I think you're going to start to see more and more of one. And what I mean by that is the first time that I could vote was the 2000 election, right? So I'm bracing myself for different potential outcomes, particularly if there's a perception that there's some sort of voter fraud or anything with how this election turned out. The point that I'm making is I do think that there is a concern that you could end up with a generation of people who believe that the system is so inherently flawed that it doesn't make a difference getting involved. I think that's what the DNC was talking about to me when they said, "We're really concerned about young black men." Why are you really concerned about young black men? Because they don't trust the man, they don't trust the system, they think that everything is stacked against them. And so I think there's a lot of pressure, I hate to say it, on this particular election for the future of this, of youth and civic engagement and potentially adult engagement, because they're going to become.
This is really important. And in the book that we just put out called Born Digital, one of the things in the last chapter on activists that we really hit on, I believe so much turns on whether or not this group is actually engaged through somebody governing with them,
right.
Not just campaigning on it, right? In this state, I'm still waiting for Governor Patrick, who did a wonderful job campaigning on it, to govern that way. I'm really hoping that our next president, whoever that might be, will govern that way. And I think that will have a lot to do with sort of breaking the cycle that this is all running up against.
Well, now that John McCain knows how to email, I think.
That's going to help. I put you on the spot, but I think I imagine there are lots of cross currents here with what you've been thinking about.
I might need clarification, because I don't see the. So I am studying people's Facebook profiles. About themselves, and these seem very consistent in that in one sense agency is being able to do something in your community, feeling empowered, but in another sense, like the tattoo metaphor, agency is about being able to show up, to tell people what you're up to. And I think you do a fantastic job of giving people the tools to get the credit they think they deserve, not only in their community but in a wider format.
So I guess the line that I was hearing in my head and then thinking about your research was the one that sort of distinguished the architecture that ObamaWorks is setting up as against the more generic kind of social networks. And maybe they're just kind of doing different things, but I heard you say something like, it's not just like a social network where in fact you now can be put in a place of honor, whereas like you're sort of buried, and I was presuming you meant Facebook and MySpace by creating those kinds of pages. And you know, I don't know if there is an architectural point somewhere that you were trying to make that might, in fact, have maybe something adjacent to work for the NSF that, you know, kind of informs that.
I mean, ultimately, the difference between, you know, the home base, which is what we call our sort of facility, you know, our application in which people can make their sites for their local groups. What distinguishes it from Facebook is that there are that you can write any HTML you darn well please, and you can use a WYSIWYG editing interface if you want, to create whatever it is that interests you. And I think ultimately I actually think that that Facebook or, you know, any social network is successful with a broad population to the extent that they do this anyway. I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, actually a good comparison would be my.barackobama.com, which is itself a social network, a very compelling one, but still a small one, and the Facebook, you know, my.barackobama.com allows you to take some very restrictive actions, and so you don't get like people spending hours and hours sort of poring over the social actions that are available, or thinking about how it is that they're going to present themselves. Ultimately, they are going to make phone calls, and they're going to do the things that the site channels them to do. They're going to spend less time doing it. Facebook is obviously much less restrictive, and people will find new, novel ways to capitalize on the agency that they've been given. I didn't want people to feel like, you know, ultimately, the reason we created the home base was because people were creating their own websites for their own chapters, their own local groups, and we were like, no, please don't do that. People will be confused. They won't know where to go. And it's like, well, how can I let them do this, but also not have them feel like a cog, you know, like another, like, you know, MoveOn.org asks you to, like, fill in your personal message here, which no one will ever read, and, you know, who is this Eli Pariser guy anyway, and, you know, whatever. So I wanted them to feel as not cogged as possible, and so that was ultimately why I did what I did.
You mentioned the altruism and the relevance of something like the Facebook little green patch, mm-hmm. okay, which something like that, the tattoo could be on the wiki, the harrisburg.obama.com. Mm-hmm. I just worry that, because I've seen even friends my age who have Facebook pages, who have MySpace pages, and who have 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 of these tattoos, if you will,
right.
on their site, which could be on a harrisburg.obama.org site as well. Through HTML, through JavaScript, and all this and that. It could be as cluttered at a Facebook page.
Sure.
And I just wonder, you know, if we take a step back and we look at this, what that's really saying, where the relevance of one passion versus another passion.
Right, well, I mean, ultimately, Harrisburg.obamaworks.org exists for a purpose, which is to promote the events that Harrisburg, you know, Pennsylvania is doing, you know, in the ObamaWorks group there. You know, I agree that, you know, the effect of the green patch or the green book or the little green patch or whatever is diluted by its presence next to, you know, 1,000 other similar widgets for other causes. I don't think it's negated, especially if it's monetized by these, you know, corporate sponsors. And also, you know, the action of inviting someone's friends isn't diluted as much by the sort of multiplicity, the profusion of events on someone's page. But ultimately, you know, I think the where the home base, if it shines, where it shines is that it's linked to, and it links to, and the agency that it provides is helping people achieve real actions in real life, and which is distinct from Facebook widgets in that way.
I just wanted to connect the last two speakers with Sunshine, and the what I'm hearing is a little bit about stories, the kind of motivation, relationships, and I'm trying to connect that with the idea of information. I'm wondering if information is distinct from, or is it kind of, are you, in particular with Sunshine, you're using the word information before, would you include kind of these things that are more like narratives and stories that have this kind of compelling idea in it, or are these kind of separate buckets, and one important thing is getting information out to people, and another important thing is helping people establish relationships with each other or find stories that motivate them to actually get involved, or are they part of the same?
Absolutely, and in fact, they're exact. I mean, I think the Gen 6 case is exactly what I was referring to. How do we create motivation? And it's by making engagement relevant to someone. And what the blogs were able to do, right, is provide the information about why a protest was, why it was relevant to them. And so, you know, there's all kinds of issues about the people who weren't reached and who didn't get the information. But I mean, this is a classic, I mean, I think it's a perfect example of just what has, you know, it's not just enough to have the information, you know, you have to get the information that engagement is relevant to people who wouldn't have otherwise imagined that engagement was relevant. And it sounds like that was one way that it happened.
Either of you want to respond to that, then we'll move to Nasser and
I'll just say really briefly that that although the Gen 6 is good example is obviously more you know, compelling and striking than the puny ObamaWorks example. It is. I mean, We did have a situation where we had a community of people who weren't necessarily turned on to what we were doing, and that community has a name. It is my.barackobama.com, and it is full of people who have given like $5, who don't really care, certainly have not thought about doing service, are excited about Obama for whatever reason, and you know, ultimately we had to sort of infect that community with what we were doing, and we were able to use, you know, support of Obama as sort of a lever, as a means to drag people out of it into something they wouldn't have otherwise been doing, service. You know, there are groups, like there's a group called Democrats Work, which I love, but which has been doing this for a long time and wasn't able to sort of to tap into the enthusiasm that we were. So it is about sort of infecting a community with information that is suddenly relevant to engage them.
And I think in your case, I mean, what you've done is you have a group of people who are motivated, right? But they don't necessarily have the other resources necessary to become engaged. And what you've done is provided those resources and incentivize also participation by allowing people to tattoo, you know, essentially, right?
Right, right.
But you start with a group that is already, and hopefully what they're doing then is going into the community and talking to friends and family who can then provide the information that says, this election is relevant to you, right? I mean, that's the hope. That's where you hope that the motivation spreads out. But you start with a group that's motivated and reduce the barriers to participation.
Oh, you want a word on that? Yeah. So I'm going to transfer the mic down. Maybe we could just peer-to-peer style pass it down. That would be great for Nasser. One of the trajectories through these three really neat presentations, I think, is going from the very immediate and political American example of political campaign through Obama Works, which I think starts to get us into other forms of civic engagement, you know, stemming from the political story. And Nasser, I think, will take us one step further in this direction by describing Hamza and a broader conception of civic life, but one that I think intersects very well with the previous one.
Thank you. Thank you, Miriam, for having me. Great job. I'd like to open simply by, sitting here and listening to fellow panelists. I could not but help and wonder with amazement actually and how difficult it is to mobilize youth in open societies. This is America. This is, in theory, a place where you can express yourself and by virtue of your citizenship, you're entitled to have your opinions, and you should be a responsible participant in one of the oldest democracies around, correct? Well, the reality is that in the context that we operate in North Africa and the Middle East, the picture is very different. That space of freedom is not allowed, simply. Throughout my own progression, growing up in a diplomatic family, getting to meet some of the main pushers in the Middle East, Arafat, Assad, Fahd, Hussein, and then moving on, making the conceptual break and becoming an anti-slavery activist and a political dissident at a very young age, that was, to me, as I reflect on it, and it's an indicative case of many of the activists that emerged from the region, is precisely because the problem of motivation is not what is lacking. There's a lot of motivation in the area because of the nature of these regimes, and also because of the rising threat, political Islam, and the ever receding space of liberties and freedoms. As a matter of fact, contrary to the popular belief, Middle Eastern countries, and certainly in North Africa, there is a margin of individual liberty. There is, in places like Morocco, there is a famous formula: you can drink, can get laid, you can dance, but stay out of the monarchy, do not speak about the monarchy, do not engage in political organization, you can have an opinion, but do not organize, and certainly do not question the status quo in the Sahara. And that's, by the way, a very mild context compared to other places. I grew up in Syria, where the leader, Assad, aside from meeting him personally, I was meeting him actually every day in my copybook and my classroom in the face. So these are very repressive systems that do not allow or afford for any sort of meaningful engagement and organization. But that precisely is their downfall, because there is never shortage of motivation to take on these systems. Now, in the era, pre-internet era, I was unlucky, you could say, to have come out of age during that time. And believe me, there was no support mechanisms whatsoever. Organizing and spreading the message was very difficult and it was very perilous exercise, because in an era where the fax machine was a wonderful feat of technology, those were severely controlled. You had you needed a space or a state authorization to get one of those, and of course you could only assume that your line is tapped. If you're suspected by affiliation, that means tribal family, or by inclination to have any sort of to present any sort of threat to the existing systems. Now, fast forward to the emergence of the internet, the beginning of the internet era. As an anti-slavery activist and a political dissident in my home country, Mauritania, that became a godsend for us, because that was the only forum we could actually express ourselves and also push forward our points, our demands for the end of slavery, demands for a more respectful approach to individual and human rights, and also demands towards political reform from a one-party system and a dictatorship to a multi-party system. And very quickly, it became the internet. The organizations that I am affiliated with, we became very quickly tagged as the electronic opposition. In their minds, in the beginning, that was an insult, but they didn't realize that that was the way of the future. And by the process, the internet allowed us to become a much more influential force than our true like size. But the reality, again, is that when you fast forward a few years ago, governments catch up with the technologies, they learn how to make websites, they learn how to censor forums, and they learn how to open their own forums, although the propaganda never works very much. It's never too effective. It's, again, one of their own downfalls. But then we arrive to the next stage, which is, I think, that's where the Hamsa experience, which is, Hamsa stands for Hands Across the Middle East Support Alliance, which is a civil rights initiative of the American Islamic Congress, which is the mother organization. We feel that, contrary to the general accepted notion and the orthodoxy that the Middle East and North Africa is a region that is plagued by the Arab-Israeli conflict and the series of the geopolitical context, that once you secure a peace agreement between the Arabs and Israel, or you disarm, stop Iran's nuclear program, that things will turn out better. Well, I take issue with that notion, and I think that there's very little evidence that would indicate how a peace agreement tomorrow between Israel and the Palestinians would improve the civil rights of a young Jordanian woman who's married to a foreigner but yet cannot pass her citizenship to her children from that marriage, or a Lebanese who squarely falls into the same category, or a Syrian Kurd who by state law cannot give a Kurdish name to his son or daughter. No incidents. The reality is that there is a growing civil rights movement in the region that is precisely aiming at securing those individual rights that are constantly under assault and under attack from those repressive regimes, who, by the way, are one of the biggest proponents of this geopolitical view. Deal with the Israeli-Palestinian issue, withdraw the troops from Iraq, and then we'll get to everything else, meaning reform. Opening. And of course, in the process, motivation and finding people who are motivated has not been our biggest problem, because there's that's not what is lacking. But the problem has been indeed identifying those likely actors, those likely leaders who would push this notion forward and actually turn the cyber activism, which is a lot of blogging. I mean, blogging has become the ultimate frontier for freedom of expression in the Middle East, that would turn these conversations on the internet, on forums, organizations on Facebook. An example of that, the latest worker strikes in Mahalla, Egypt, last April, that was purely started by Facebook, by a Facebook initiative that was not affiliated with any political party or organization, and make the next conceptual jump, which is bringing that that activism and that energy back to the real world. Now, of course, any movement and any needs leaders. And the way we have gone about finding and identifying these leaders and supporting them is that we came up with a series of online tools. One of the most important one of these is what we call the Dream Deferred Essay Context. It's a reference to a Langston Hughes poem, What Happens to a Dream, dream Deferred? Does it explode? Through the essay contest, which we have ran for 3 years, and we will be starting soon the fourth edition, we have identified, for example, a remarkable young lady who is a blogger, a poetess, and a human rights and civil rights activist who actually runs our office Cairo right now, Dalia Ziada. We have managed to find a young Arab male feminist who's currently working on a project that we're pushing, and is to create a counter-narrative to the Islamist narrative around women's rights. So that online tool that allowed us to get to some of the most interesting and most upcoming activists in the region has been a breakthrough, because the trick was really to give incentive, because of course winning the essay contest translates into monetary gain. There are prizes. We hand out cash prizes, $10,000. We do that. By the way, the essay contest has to, we do it in the Middle East and in the United States in a hope to connect young Americans who enjoy the freedoms afforded by the constitution of this country. Some people would say receding, but I think that irrelevant considered in the Middle East context, to precisely organize and push this nascent movement. But again, one of the beauties of the essay contest is that also oftentimes those who do not write great essays turn out to be some of the most amazing organizers. And that became plain to us, because the next stage from the essay context, we do organize on a yearly basis anywhere between 3 and 5 conferences in the region, where we team up with other organizations to impart leadership skills, basic organization skills, and also the use of new technologies. And that became manifest because after our first conference, one of the participants, a young Egyptian blogger, became the first casualty of the 21st century information war in the Middle East. He was sent to jail for allegedly insulting Islam and President Mubarak. Those people who didn't write great essays immediately turned into a protection network. Bloggers who came together and pushed an amazing campaign that is still ongoing to demand the release of Karim Amir. That's the blogger's name. And the same model was replicated, and we learned the lesson that we needed to come prepared rather than come up with the old model of protection for activists, to have a proactive model. So as you can see, online tools have been going and getting refined and moving to the next stage, just to push a simple notion that actually ultimately people on the ground in the Middle East do not need foreigners to come to tell them what they should think and how they should go about their business. But what we do is that we facilitate that by the use of new technologies, and also ultimately facilitate the growth of the civil rights movement to offer a real alternative to some real problems. And I'm sad to say that a lot of this movement completely goes underneath camera lenses, while the media lenses are, looking at some of the most egregious things. These are movements that are happening right now as we speak, and they have the potential of changing the Middle East from what we know it to be. And on a very last note, 300 seconds. 300 to make a very to simplify a very complex story. Jumping here to the United States through we do interfaith work, and also we have a students initiative. One of the things that became very apparent to us that as Muslims in an open society, one of the things that we're taking on continuously because of the reality, the dismal reality coming out of the region, is terrorism, violence. And to our surprise, if you go and I mean, not meaning to challenge you here in a negative way, but I'll be surprised if anyone in this room would be able to name one Muslim victim of any terrorist attack in the last 5 years. That's not an accident. It's not because of your disinterest. It's just because we consistently tracked through this summer. We had a project that was, by the way, was impulsed by members of the campus project, and realized that media in the United States, in the West, which is not really a big surprise, does not keep track of, dehumanizes victims of terrorism, Muslim victims of terrorism, because ultimately, through the research, we found out that actually terrorism is more of a Muslim problem than a Western problem, if you simply take into account the number of victims. So we proceeded, okay, solution. We are in the process of using Facebook, social networking technologies, to put a human face on campuses by having students adopt virtual profiles of students who were killed in these terrorist attacks. And I'm mentioning this point precisely because this is an example of social responsible leadership exercised by students who really wanted to address a problem that is ever present. So the lesson here is that also one needs to listen instead of pushing onto the audience, the target audience, what is it that is they really care about, and provide them with solutions. I'll stop here.
Thank you. Very, very good. Thank you for broadening our frame and also bringing in the topic, really, of the creativity of the people who are blogging and writing. And I think you helpfully put that on the table as, is that itself political action? Does it need to be something more? Or is it, and I think it comes back to Sunshine's point about making more information available, but also brings it to the fact that sometimes young people are making that information available, and that seems to be a very different act than just sort of having the information out there. That's a sort of a helpful twist on it. So maybe a couple comments on this, and then we'll get to Judith's and spring it in there. We'll have at this challenging story. Yeah.
So you mentioned using a lot of all of you did, in fact, using existing technologies for these kinds of social action. We've got some Facebook in there, blogging, which is in web years old, and Wikipedia also in web years, very old. And so I'm wondering, is it an advantage to your work to use existing well-established tools, or secretly in your heart, are you dying for some new thing, for some new way of communicating, some new way of organizing, some new way of protecting identity that does not exist yet, or really is, are existing platforms good enough?
That's a very good question. Actually, we're always dying for better and better technologies. As a matter of fact, one example of that is that we have letter writing capability. After every time activists that we come across, some of them unfortunately come under fire. In the case, for example, of Fuad al-Farhan, came to one of our conferences, we do launch a letter writing campaign that is part of the protection network concept that I mentioned, being proactive. That's an entirely a software that we came up with in-house. It allows us within, from the moment we take a decision to launch a campaign, 90 minutes. We have a campaign up and running with a petition, with demands, and also with a website. But to tie it back, actually, we because of the time constraint here, I didn't have the time to explore all the technologies that we've been using. But Twitter, Skype, actually, just to simply put it, 2 weeks ago there was a storm in the Boston area, and the Verizon internet service was interrupted. We just had to pack and go home. So that's how heavily we rely on these technologies. Now, yes, it would be very helpful to have some specific technologies that would help us, for example, evade censorship. which is a growing problem in the Middle East. It would be also particularly helpful to have some sort of technologies that would answer. One of the most bizarre incidents that we had to deal with as one of the winners of the essay contest last year is in Iran. How do we pass the funds to him? Because there are existing American legislation that would you'd have to deal with, because Iran is under a series of embargoes, and also because of the person's safety. Just writing him or her a check and putting it in the mail for the Iranian Post to see coming from America with American and Islamic Congress isn't exactly the best way to look after that person's security. PayPal came up as one of the possibilities, but there was a glitch there. Anyway, so yes, there is a huge demand for specific technologies that would help us deal with precisely operate with that within that restrictive context. Thank you.
I'm the only visualish person I rely on these things. So thanks so much, Anne, to Miriam and all of you for inviting me to come. I'm going to really, I think, first of all, thanks. I know the sugar from the cookies is dwindling, so I really appreciate everyone kind of sticking it out till the end. But hopefully this will be a little more interesting, upbeat switch of pace from the other things, which have been very, very interesting in getting me to think about my own research in very different ways. Really fascinating. So thank you to the other speakers as well. My research at MIT involves the development of educational technology tools. As the name suggests, the program at whole actually does prepare undergrads who want to become teachers. That's not what I'm involved in. I'm involved in the second 2 points, my collaboration with teachers, both here in Boston, nationally and internationally, in fact, to implement these technologies, and then my role as a research manager to design, oversee the development, and then conduct the research around these next generation technologies. So what I'll be speaking to you about today is one of those projects, the augmented reality. So we've been talking today about different ways in which technologies can be the tools to motivate, engage, communicate among youth as a way towards a path towards civic engagement. I'll also add games as another possible component. There's a whole, of course, serious games movement, many of which use, for political reasons, have developed their own games. Basically, everyone from the military to activist causes to education is starting to sort of conduct some serious research around games as powerful learning tools. And we take that to heart in our research as well, looking at kinds of learning environments that games can foster, which are really highly engaged, motivating things that immerse students in the immersive environments, which I'll talk about today, with problems that are hopefully relevant to them in a very social, very collaborative, project-based way that are challenging to them and that really kind of skirt the boundaries between formal and informal learning. So I think hearing a lot of what you had to say made me really think about the ways in which we really are talking about seeing, youth's perception of civics as, is it relevant to me? Is it something that I can see myself immersed in through social networks or through my own experience? Is it something I'm highly engaged in? Do I have the motivation? So there's a lot of, I think, parallels between us. So that was a nice point. In particular, the research that I do is around augmented reality. So by that, I mean a computer simulation, in our case, which runs on a commercial off-the-shelf handheld computer, like you might have seen, an iPac, an HP iPac, or an iPhone, things like that, that is triggered by a real-world location. So these are location-based learning experiences. You can see in the picture there a screenshot of, in this case, the Columbus Zoo, but that's basically a map of a location there. There are icons on that map representing hotspots, so those are virtual characters, virtual objects. That arrow, the big orange arrow, is pointing to a little orange triangle, which represents you in your real-world location. So if you think of Harry Potter's Marauder map, where it shows your real-time location on the map, that's equivalent to what this is. And as you walk around these environments, which know your location, as you get to those locations, virtual data, virtual information, virtual characters pop up. So that's the augmented part of the augmented reality. You're walking around the real space, in this case, the zoo, or in the picture above, the MIT campus, or fill in the blank, anywhere, your local community, and there's a digital overlay of information in that real physical space. So today I'm just going to talk really briefly about one of our most recent games called TimeLab 2100. This is a game we have been developing in with funding and in collaboration with actually some folks over at CMS and the Media Lab and the Center for Future Civic Media at MIT. And this particular game is about global climate change policy. In this, the players are given a scenario where they time travel ahead to 2100 Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they go around the real world locations on the MIT or greater Cambridge area, and they interact with characters and objects which demonstrate to them some of the negative effects that global climate change has had in the future. So in the gameplay, the students actually investigate these potential 2008 laws which could help. So they look at basically rising floods or buildings that did not have adequate protection from the elements or inadequate health preparation. And they basically see these effects and then they think, what could we have done differently if we had a chance 100 years ago to quote unquote get it right? So they basically go around these locations and see things that are closely tied to the physical landscape around the MIT campus, different buildings, different views of things, proximity to water, et cetera. And then they work in these small groups to investigate. The interface looks something like this. So you can interview virtual characters, you can go to places, and you actually interface with proposed laws. So as you walk around, you not only learn more general issues about global climate change, but you see proposed laws that could be put on a 2008 ballot. So half of the parking spaces should be restricted to shared vehicles, or public transportation should be free, or we should evacuate Cambridge and give people relocation fees because it's too close to the water, which, given the events of last week, may have seemed slightly unrealistic in the game, but people are probably thinking about sadly these days. So, so these are the kinds of interactions that students have throughout the game, and we sort of archive the laws in one place so the students can refer back to them. The students actually go out in groups and don't all see all the laws. So, one third of the class might see a third of the laws, another third might go to the other ones, etc. So they're sort of jigsawing in effect the information that they're going to come back and pool together as a group when they reconvene. So they walk around for about an hour, then they come back inside, kind of consider what they've observed, sort of prioritized among the laws they've seen, the ones they think would be most effective, and by effective we have them, we give them sort of criteria by which to judge, meaning how popular they'd be, because we're not putting the law into action, we're putting it on the ballot, so we're trying to, again, get them to think about civic engagement, not just what they would do if they had, the hand of power, but what they think would be reasonable for voters to enact, but also what would have the greatest effect on global climate change. So indoors, as a whole class, they go through a rather prescribed nomination and voting process where we really scaffold that for the students to sort of facilitate those kinds of discussions, where we hope that they use evidence and show through argumentation, and then they actually prepare remarks and present them to their peers in class. So there's a public speaking component and an argumentation component to this as well. This past spring and summer, we had several trials with pretty diverse groups of students, middle school and high school students, college-age students, adults, and actually families, where we had pairs of adults and children playing as teams together, which was very interesting, as part of the Cambridge Science Festival. Some of the outcomes were that they found it to be fairly engaging, as the scenario prompted people to think about these issues in a very local way, something which people commented to us they hadn't quite done before. So they might have thought on a global level that, there's a lot of carbon emissions and we should reduce them, but they didn't think how practically in day-to-day life that here in Cambridge or here policies might actually impact that. So some of the challenges, however, that we found in creating a game like this was sort of somewhat new territory. We'd done some games before about civic engagement, another project called Posit, which was about controversial science issues and things along those lines. But this was somewhat new territory for us, was really balancing a few things in terms of the clarity with the scientific nuance was an interesting thing. We've been talking more generally, I think, about political events, but when often science is in the news, there's a real challenge with presenting quantitative or other information in a way that doesn't dumb it down so much that it really becomes, in essence, useless, but at the same time is not expect someone to have a PhD to interpret it. So scientific literacy becomes part of it, and what you can assume of your audience. Presenting data through this local lens was an interesting challenge. So if you want people to think locally and think about policies that they can enact on a local level that they actually have some agency to have some campaigning and some voice in? How do you make that relevant? And to really challenge students without overwhelming them. And of course, making the game component compelling for a wide range of participants, because most, but not all, for example, like the future theme. So, you know, sort of coming up with a game or a scenario that's appealing to people, just like coming up with a website or a you know, a look and feel that will be appealing to men and women, young and old. You know, all of these challenges are things that I think everyone faces who's in any kind of media production that's not necessarily user-generated in this case. And the topic, while inherently interesting for some, really was less interesting for others, and they were more interested in the gameplay component. So that's an interesting form of this lever. So for some people, the competitiveness and the ability to achieve and do be successful in an action was the interesting part, not that it was about climate change per se. So that's sort of a plus and a minus, because they come in not necessarily being interested in this kind of civic engagement, but maybe you get them to be interested, but then you sort of have a hard sell, right? Because then you sort of have to convince them that, look, this is a really interesting topic and you should care about it without being preachy. That's just one example of games. We've done a number of other games using the same sort of genre format of augmented reality, and they've been on a range of topics in a range of different kinds of locations and in a range of different kind of time spans. Some, you know, half hour to an hour experiences, some 2 hours, some over the course of a week. So in thinking about how these kinds of digital tools, I mean, I think most people can picture what a website looks like, but because it's hard if you haven't played an augmented reality game to sort of get a sense of, well, is this a tool that, you know, how would it be used and how might you use this to engage people in civic-minded causes, whether they be scientific or more general, just sort of giving you a little smattering of some of the other, although with limited time, I don't have time to go into a couple of examples. But we do have an authoring toolkit that we've developed. So the idea here is that non-programmers can actually download and create their own augmented reality game. So if you have the equipment, you can make your own game. You can make at about whatever content or civic engagement or science or anything you wanted through a drag and drop kind of interface, and then you can download it to your PDA and play your own augmented reality game. So there is sort of a Web 2.0 user-generated content component to this. It's not that the players are all simultaneously authoring the game, but that anyone sort of could make their own augmented reality game. So it's on that level at this time, although who knows, that could change in the future too. I'll really quickly, just in closing, mention two other projects that are currently going on, which also have a civic youth component. The first one is actually the map I showed you is at the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium, where we've created a two-hour field trip using augmented reality, which actually engages participants in thinking about the endangered wildlife trade, the illegal wildlife trade. So the zoo, who sees their mission as more just than animals, of course, in cages, which they want to do more outreach and more civic-minded, purposeful education, was really interested in getting these messages across. And since students have a hard time just reading little plaques next to things on field trips when they want to run around to the gift shop and take pictures with their friends, wanted a very highly engaging way for their participants to think about these sort of higher, broader issues. So we created an augmented reality game for them, which has sort of a mystery component, but in essence is about the endangered wildlife trade. The second project I'll mention really quickly, which Josh here is one of the leaders of, is actually with our partnership with the Missouri Botanical Garden, which is in the, engages with students in upper elementary and middle school in urban and rural St. Louis area. And it's through an NSF-funded grant, which is called LIONS, Local Investigations of Natural Science. And this involves students kind of authoring local games, which have somewhat of a science component, but also sort of a local history component. And in essence, that winds up because of cultural, racial, and other socioeconomic factors, often having a civic component as well, which is very interesting. There's also, in this curriculum, actually, the students are not only playing augmented reality games, but authoring their own augmented reality games. So they're really conceptualizing how the local environment and their experience when for an audience, when they're authoring this game, how those things all tie together. And there's also a service learning component. So they're creating these sort of augmented reality games, and then they're also figuring out related service learning projects that go along with them. So I know I glossed over those really quickly, and there's a lot more I could say about them, as everyone else could with their work, but I'll just leave it at that for now, and thank you.
Judy, thank you, and thanks to each of the speakers. That's very nice. I know each of you has had to rush through life's work in 5 minutes. I really, really appreciate it, but I think together it seems like there's a really very interesting story that's emerged here between the kinds of things you're doing. Sunshine, I don't know, by way of sort of getting toward a closure here, as some people seem to be sleeping from the room, if you might just take a crack at, from the frame that you established, look back at some of these other presentations and see if you can help us kind of bring them back into the frame that you
created, and should we be hopeful or not hopeful? Are we headed in the right direction? What are you seeing here?
Well, so I guess I would just say that when we think about, okay, is a young person going to be engaged or not, that it's so simple as to say that people will become engaged when the costs outweigh, or the benefits outweigh the costs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the, whether those costs are psychological, whether those costs or those benefits are psychological or social or material, that to think about it in terms of the costs and benefits, and we start, I think, seeing how, you know, new media can really reduce costs. The social networking can increase benefits. I don't think that it closes the gap between older people and younger people. You know, when you have a 25% of young people turning out to vote in 2006 versus 53% of people who are 50 plus, you know, there are still substantial costs that are not related to information of just being young and not being in a community, not being settled, not being married, you know, all of the things that affect the cost of participation. But that said, I think that each of the different projects, especially, it's really nice to be able to see how they offer benefits to young people or in some way reduce the cost of participation. And maybe that gives us some, like, looking forward, you know, you could anticipate who's going to be reactive to a particular initiative, depending on what is being offered, like whether you're reducing costs or offering benefits.
Oh, Beth or others who haven't maybe had a chance to jump in, do you want last words or reflections? Put anybody on the spot, but sure. Just to be sure that there's space for anybody who hasn't had access to the mic. Any of the panelists want to have final comments, or should we leave it with Sunshine?
I'll just say really quickly, this is minor, but if anyone's going and checking out the home base on our site, I want to sort of insert a caveat that it was just only recently launched, so it's not fully populated with all sorts of exciting things just yet.
Come back another time. Well, I just want to say thank you to each of you. This really is it gives me a lot of hope, just really seeing people focused on this issue and in ways that are creative and inventive. I don't know that anybody has a specific answer to the kinds of problems that Sunshine teed up, but I think these kinds of experiments are really the only thing we can do right now, and clearly getting some great results. So thank you for sharing them here, and thank you to everybody who watched online. So take care. Thank you again to Miriam for pulling it off.
Cool.
Well,
thanks.
Yes. To ask you a little sort of a more technical question about your